when we were putting this together, we were thinking what kind of keynote address could possibly bridge the kind of issues that we were trying to get to here and get beyond our regular cast of characters who present at these kinds of meetings. And we were thrilled to be able to find Sandra DeCastro Buffington, who is the director of Hollywood Health and Society, a program at the USC Annenberg Norman Lear Center that leverages the power of the entertainment industry to improve health and well-being of individuals and communities worldwide. Sandra works with leading Hollywood scriptwriters and producers with the goal of improving accuracy of health-related storylines on top television programs and films, resulting in 221 aired stories in just 2011. They're funded by CDC, the California Endowment, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and the Skoll Foundation, among others, and have been recognized for the profound impact they are having on the entertainment industry in getting these global health and public health messages out. Sandra has also brought some of these writers and producers to South Africa and India, and that itself, those trips and her work with the panels, have resulted in a 600% increase in global health storylines in the top 20 scripted shows between 2009 and 2011. Sandra has nearly 30 years of experience working in global health, the entertainment industry, and emerging technologies, working internationally and living overseas for about 5 years. But she also had Washington roots. She was the vice president of CEDPA, the Center for Development and Population Activities that many of us know about, and she was also with USAID for a time. She has received numerous awards, including the USAID Maximizing Access and Quality Outstanding Achievement Award for her global health and social change programs, and Brazil's award for leadership in developing the Bahia State Reproductive Health Program. She's a former associate faculty member at Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health and a past board member of the Pan American Health and Education Foundation. We are delighted that she agreed to fly across the country to join us here today. Please help join me in welcoming Sandra DeCastro Buffington.
So good afternoon, everyone, and I better move this up. Can you hear me? Okay. I'd like to thank the organizers for this wonderful conference and the opportunity to speak with you today. And I'd like to congratulate CSIS on the launch of the new video on vaccines, the very powerful video. And I work in Hollywood, so I can tell you that. We know that anyone can make the simple complicated. But creativity is making the complicated simple. And that comes from Charlie Mingus, the great jazz musician. And I think this really sort of lays the foundation for the work that we're talking about today, taking very complex policy issues and global health issues and delivering them in a compelling and simple way. So what is dramatic storytelling? Well, this is something we ask Hollywood scriptwriters and producers. And for them, it comes down to three things. Great stories that communicate simple truths that reflect the dimensions of the human soul. Powerful characters that help us understand our lives, and their stories reflect our core values. And finally, meaningful themes that universalize the human experience and help the audience relate. So I'd like to share an example of this with you. We're going to look at a very short clip of this episode of Law & Order SVU called Selfish. Has anybody seen this episode besides Janet? Anybody seen it? You may recognize it. We worked with the writers of SVU by connecting them with vaccine experts at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And I'm going to actually read to you the experts' three key messages to the scriptwriters. The three messages from CDC were, measles is one of the most infectious diseases affecting humans with serious health consequences, especially for infants. Okay, that's one. The measles vaccine is extremely effective in preventing measles. And the third is failure to immunize against measles not only puts the individual at risk, but everyone around the individual at risk. And so, to set up this little clip, this is a story really about two mothers. One is the young, irresponsible mother whose little daughter, I think she was 12 months old, was found dead. And it was assumed that this was through some kind of abuse. But actually, it was the consequences of measles. And the other mother, who looks like the responsible, upstanding mother of a 5-year-old, decided not to immunize her son. And it turned out these two children met and played together on a playground, and the littler one was too young to be immunized and ended up contracting measles and dying. So let's take a look. This is a courtroom scene.
But you didn't think about how your choice would affect other children.
Sierra Walker isn't my child. I can't make choices for her.
But you did. You made a choice, and now she's dead. Your actions are directly responsible for her death. If she hadn't contracted measles, she would still be alive.
Is there a question here, Your Honor?
Is there, Miss Cabot?
Miss Stewart, what is your medical degree in?
I don't have one.
But you were making medical choices on behalf of your child.
Just because I don't have a degree doesn't mean I can't be an informed parent.
You chose your informed opinion over that of people who do in fact have a medical degree and understand the science behind vaccinations and recommend that all kids be vaccinated.
I know what's best for my child.
If you know what's best, and the doctors are of a different opinion, then it stands to reason that they don't have your child's best interest at heart.
Their science is just another opinion.
Your opinion killed a little girl.
Your Honor.
I'm just trying to show that if Miss Stewart had vaccinated her child, Sierra Walker would be alive today.
I'm not sure that's true.
You're not.
That woman was a horrible mother. It was just a matter of time until something tragic happened.
You're the one on trial, Miss Stewart.
Exactly. And how fair is that? I'm the good mother. I make sure my child eats well, is taken care of. She buried her daughter in a shallow grave.
Yes. She buried the child that you murdered.
So, Hollywood Health and Society measures the impact of these storylines. So I'm going to show you some measures throughout this presentation, and we'll start with a measure of attitude change. So I'll explain the process. There are a lot of caveats in our being able to do research on the impact of these stories. First, the writers have to tell us when the story is going to air. Second, they have to be willing to give us the script ahead of time. And SVU works with us all the time and trusts us, and so they gave it to us readily. Then we do a content analysis of all of the health content in the storyline, and we develop a questionnaire. We go through IRB, just like everybody here who does research, and we contract with a private research firm that administers our survey to regular viewers of primetime television. So this episode actually resulted in significant attitude changes. So the question of all children should be vaccinated, there were significant increases in that belief. Parents are wrong not to vaccinate. And actually, this was stated in the negative. Parents are making the right decision for their children when they don't get the child the measles vaccine. Among those exposed to the storyline, there is a significant decrease in that belief. The science behind vaccines is wrong. Significant decrease. Negative vaccination attitude scale, we had a whole scale on this, also decreased as the result of exposure to the storyline. So one thing to remember about these shows, for example, SVU, this episode reached about 11 million viewers the first time it aired. Then the network aired it 4 times. By the end of the first month, it has reached 57 million viewers. Then it goes to syndicated rerun in over 100 countries around the world forevermore. I mean, these things get repeated over and over and over again. So our work has actually been funded for the last 11 years by the CDC. We also have funding from SCOLE, the California Endowment, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, AHRQ, Barr Foundation, Grantham. We've also partnered with NCI, ONDCP, SAMHSA, a lot of these, the alphabet, you know, soup that only you in Washington would actually know. And how do we do this work? Well, we actually do it in 5 ways. We do sustained and systematic outreach to the entertainment industry. And we do this in many ways, but the principal way is through briefings and consultations with writers. we take experts, like many of you in this room, right into the writers' rooms of Grey's Anatomy, Private Practice, House, Law and Order, NCI, Disney animated shows. We're actually helping Disney launch a new animated series next week when I get back that is all health. It's all about little stuffed animals and it's health. And it addresses getting shots, by the way. You'll be happy to know that. But so we do these briefings to inspire writers to write about health. And with support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, specifically to focus on global health. And this was difficult because in our media monitoring, we do media monitoring every year of the top 20 scripted shows, we found that less than 2% of all health storylines in the top 20 shows addressed any aspect of global health. That was 2009. So we had to work very hard to help writers. And it was interesting hearing the panelists today. I think Dan mentioned the importance of real stories and authenticity. And so in our work with scriptwriters, we don't pitch storylines. That's not our job. They're the master storytellers. They come up with the storylines. But what we do is pitch case studies or real stories of real people. And that's what engages their creative process. And that's how these stories end up on the air. We also take, what I'm going to do is show you some slides to illustrate these points. But we do story tours. We do research trips. We have a lot of materials we provide to writers. Our outreach to the public is through the entertainment storylines, but we also use a transmedia approach. So we use a TV storyline as the driver of viewers to other platforms. So we use public service announcements that, by the way, we don't pay for any of this. Through our relationships with the networks, we ask them, can we do a PSA? Will you give us your lead actor? They pay for all production costs. We simply work with what could be one of you in this room, the expert source on the copy. And then you'll see that copy come out of the mouth of the lead actor in the PSA, referring viewers to call-in hotline numbers and to websites. We placed over 800 web links on shows' websites last year, linking viewers to credible sources of information. So we're making this connection so that viewers can learn more and then take action. We do outreach to policymakers. We hold events here on Capitol Hill, and we found that it's very helpful to partner with the entertainment industry if we want the attention of Congress. And it really is the only way we found to keep, you know, congressional offices in the room and engaged is if we bring, we don't celebrity wrangle very often, but we will bring celebrities if we're doing a big event on the Hill. It definitely helps. And we do a lot of research and evaluation, and I'm going to show it to you instead of talk about it here. And our strategic partnerships are really important. The Writers Guild of America West is our partner, and the president of the Writers Guild is the co-chair of my board. So we have access to their entire mailing list for our events, and that's helpful. So in terms of results, last year alone, as was said earlier, Janet said, we confirmed 221 aired storylines on health topics we consulted with the writers on. And we consulted across 36 shows and 15 different networks and placed these web links. Now, we also held panel discussions. We do this every year at the Writers Guild of America West. And we had one on 5 simple ways to save a life. And the keynote speech was on vaccines. And we had the head of the vaccine program from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation as our keynote speaker. And that inspired some of the stories. I don't know if any of you saw the storyline on vaccines on Private Practice last year. That was another one we worked on that was very compelling. I took a group of writers to India and South Africa with Gates support this year for the first time. And it was absolutely life-changing. I had executives from Grey's Anatomy, Private Practice, Nickelodeon, Disney Pixar, and a new show called Touch. I don't know if you've seen the pilot. Check that show out. It launches next week, and it's going to be telling global health storylines throughout the season. And it was very powerful in motivating these writers to first of all learn about global health in a local context and hear real stories from real people on the ground in the areas where you are all working in the field. And there is nothing more powerful than that for the creative process. Because that was so successful, I thought, if it works in Johannesburg and Bombay, why can't this work in East LA? So we just launched our Storybus Tour series, taking writers and producers into the inner city. And the last tour was focused on violence as a community health issue. And we met a lot of former gang members. We went to Homeboy Industries and Homegirl Cafe, a huge public school that's grappling with gang violence. So this is another way we give writers direct experience. So let's look at a very short clip, an even shorter clip from The Bold and the Beautiful. This was a storyline about heterosexual transmission of HIV and about reducing stigma. And again, we used CDC experts as our consultants.
I'm sick, Kristen.
What do you mean you're sick?
The doctor gave me a blood test and it came back positive.
For what? Tony, what was the test for?
HIV. I'm HIV positive.
Okay, so this was a 3-episode story arc. It was just a minor storyline. In episode 1, Tony learns he's HIV positive. Episode 2, he tells his fiancée, Kristen. In episode 3, they get married and adopt a child. I know. Okay, whatever. So... here's our graph. But the results were really powerful. Wait till you see this. I'm serious. Okay, Bold and the Beautiful, probably nobody in this room's ever seen it, but maybe you have. So the network let us use Tony in a PSA, which aired at 2 dramatic plot points in the story. On August 3rd, you can see the lower red arrow when Tony learned he was HIV positive. And on August 13th, when Tony told Kristen he was HIV positive. Now, this PSA referred viewers to the CDC's AIDS call-in hotline number, okay? That resulted in the highest peak in callers all year to the CDC hotline number, 5,313 calls in a single day. We tracked all references in the media to this hotline number. So 60 Minutes, you can see the blue arrow, the Surgeon General's PSA. You can see MTV actually had 2 campaigns. And the second highest was the Wrap It Up, Get Tested campaign, which is very highly financed in every media market in this country. And still, nothing came close to a minor storyline on The Bold and the Beautiful to get viewers to call an AIDS hotline number. Let that sink in for a minute when we think about our credible sources of information on 60 Minutes and our Surgeon General. Okay. I think I'd also like to point out that even with MTV, and MTV is an amazing partner. We partner with them all the time, and we love the work they do. But if it's a simple PSA and not something more integrated, you just don't get the action trigger that you get when there's a compelling story triggering the action. So I'm going to show you a transmedia campaign. And this was on traumatic brain injury. We consulted with the writers of Army Wives, this show, and we know that the First Lady is very committed to military families, and this just happened to, you know, occur at a time when there was a big focus on addressing military families in the media, so everybody was very happy with this. So we had a storyline that spanned about 6 weeks, you know. It was going to start with a very minor story, and it grew into a major story as the writers learned about traumatic brain injury. So let's take a look at the diagnosis.
The functional MRI confirms what we suspected, Colonel Burton. You're suffering from traumatic brain injury. most likely sustained during your RPG incident in Iraq.
Dr. Patterson, I dove behind the Humvee when that RPG went off. I caught some shrapnel, but I was mostly protected from the blast.
Not exactly. The energy from that explosion went through the Humvee and through you. It literally rattled your brain.
So that was over 6 months ago. How could I get TBI now?
You didn't. I suspect the symptoms have always been there. You simply didn't notice them or chose to ignore them. We found that some soldiers with TBI can function well in the field in highly routine tasks. It's when they come home and face the challenges of everyday living that the problems more fully emerge.
Okay, that's just to give you a flavor. So we used multiple platforms, you know, to form a campaign around traumatic brain injury. So the transmedia outreach included Twitter. And so we actually had CDC write the tweets, and then we asked the show to tweet to their fan base. And the actor, Wendy Davis, tweeted to her personal fan base, "I'm so honored to be able to talk to you about the impact of traumatic brain injury." And then CDC tweeted to their fan base, the lowest tweet there on the screen, says that, you know, CDC partners with Lifetime TV to raise awareness about traumatic brain injury on Army Wives. So they're driving viewers back that way. We used Facebook, so we helped the CDC set up a Facebook page on brain injury with a whole discussion thread and their experts weighing in, linked to the Army Wives Facebook page that we built for them. And Joan, the character Joan, Wendy Davis, did a little home video for us. And she just talks to her fans and viewers about what it's like portraying a character with brain injury. And there's this whole discussion thread. And then we partnered with Lifetime Networks to put content on their website. You can see here, Army Wives supports traumatic brain injury with, does it show the web links here? If you see at the bottom, these web links to the CDC page. So we're not just entertaining people. We're driving traffic through the entertainment to credible sources of information. And they're mostly government sources. So that to give you a sense of transmedia. Now I'd like to give you a sense of behavior change. And I chose this particular clip not because it's global health related, but because of the impact evaluation I want to share.
Well, I'm now officially an organ donor. Check it out.
Hey, look at that.
Boy, what cool.
Nice, huh? All right, so now I get treated with a little more respect around here.
You know, if more people took that simple step, can you imagine the ramifications?
Well, basic economic theory, black markets rely on a shortage of a regulated commodity.
That's right. Increase supply, the black market disappears.
Well, here's a couple extra applications in case anyone wants.
Well, that's all right. I already got my sticker.
Yeah, look, I've been an organ donor for years.
Yeah, me too.
This was very rare. It's almost like having a PSA built into the episode. Don't count on this again. We were very lucky to get this to happen, but we actually evaluated four different storylines on Numbers, CSI, House, and Grey's Anatomy dealing with organ transplantation. But this one actually shows the driver's license and the little sticker motivated 10% of viewers of that episode to sign up to become organ donors. This was not an intention. This was that they signed up to become organ donors. So if anybody tells you that TV is fluff, remember this data point because it really does work. Okay, so we have a Hollywood Health and Society TV monitoring project to do media mapping. And we actually map all of the health content in the top 20 scripted shows from January to May every year. We have a very complex system. We train graduate students at USC in how to code. We code for more than 70 different health topics, including global health and climate change. And then we can do an analysis like this. This was from 2011 to see kind of the spread of the most frequently portrayed health topics. And you can see in 2011, violence accounted for 45% of the health issues or health consequences depicted in those top 20 shows. And I mentioned this to you that in 2009, only 2% of storylines had any global health-related content. And within the first year, 2010, we increased that by 300%. By 2011, from baseline, it was a 600% increase. So this form of sustained and systematic outreach works. It really depends on what we focus on and how we address it with the writers and producers. We use an incentive and reward system, and that is through our Sentinel for Health Awards ceremony. And as you know, Hollywood is very sort of award-oriented, and we hold these awards at the Writers Guild of America West. And if any of you are going to be in Los Angeles at the end of September, any one of these years, let me know, and we'd love to welcome you to the ceremony. It's packed. It is one of the kind of few times that the people behind the scenes actually get to stand up and give their acceptance speeches, and it's very moving. And they say to us, you know, this is the only time we know we've actually helped anybody. So they care about that. And we give awards for primetime drama, major storyline, minor storyline, children's programming, global health, and telenovelas. We work a lot with Spanish language telenovelas. And we just added this year a category for climate change. So creativity takes courage. And everybody in the room today has that courage, especially CSIS. This is a big risk, and you made this first effort, and it's very exciting. I hope it will continue. I'd also like to share one other point in closing. There's been a lot of talk today about what makes for compelling storytelling, and we know from the scientific literature that the single most important element in compelling storytelling is transportation, and that is actually a measure of engrossment. And so the degree of engrossment in a story, let's just look at it this way. We know we're engrossed in a story when we lose track of time, we forget our surroundings, we come to see the characters as beloved family or friends. We don't want the story to end. We're transported at that point. And research shows there are much higher knowledge gains, attitude changes, and behavior changes because of transportation. So with that, I'll thank you and take some questions. Okay. Yes.
Isabella Terra, I'm alumni of the Bloomberg, and thank you very much. Your presentation was very interesting, and I'm also with the NCI, the National Cancer Institute. My question had to do with the Latino and the novelas that you were mentioning, started to allude to, and I was wondering if another was very popular Brazilian telenovela that was looking at cloning, and it was called The Clone. And I was wondering if bioethics, if there has been a push, because the cloning was looking at the bioethical implications of a scientist cloning his son. And I'm wondering if that area, just interested, if curiosity, if you had been looking into that area.
Thank you for that question. That's very interesting. It was the most popular novella in Brazil. I'm actually Brazilian. It was called O Clone, and it was so successful, it was picked up by Telemundo and adapted to El Clone. And we actually worked with the creators of the Spanish language version at Telemundo. We did not address that particular issue, but what we did is we got a great cervical cancer storyline into El Clon. In fact, the writers of that episode won an award at the Sentinel for Health Awards last year. So, you know, we actually have no control over sort of the outcome of these stories. And so this approach isn't for everyone. But let me say this. I worked for more than 20 years doing public health campaigns and other kinds of global health work. My work was in developing countries, and I used a very traditional public health approach. You know, in our world here in Washington, we pay for things. So we'll maybe have a key issue. We develop a set of key messages, and we pay somebody to write a script about them. Then we pay to air this on television. Now, this could be a 30-second spot, or it could be, you know, a 9-month telenovela. And by paying for things, we have total control from beginning to end. And you get measurable results, and there's an important role for that approach. But there's not enough money in the world or time to make all of the campaigns we need on all of the critical development topics we need to address. And so this approach, really, Hollywood Health and Society kind of flips this campaign model upside down. And so instead of having control and paying for these stories, we are supporting an industry that's already thriving. Hollywood, Bollywood, Nollywood, Sollywood, Riowood all support themselves. They're thriving entertainment industries. There's huge demand. They don't need our money. Okay, private sector. So we came in with a free resource model. And so instead of telling them, just be good people and think the way we do, don't you know how much you can help the world? They wouldn't even talk to us if we did that. We said to them, what is your goal? And they say, it's to tell the most compelling story I can. We say, we're going to help you make your stories more compelling if they have to do with health or climate change. We'll help you make them more realistic, more believable. And that's the approach we take. And in the end, they meet their goals and they meet our goals. But it's all we do is support a small group of people. So if you calculate the airtime for 221 health storylines in the span of a year, and if you use advertising, you know, rates from advertising age, and then you compare that to the cost for supporting a small group of people doing this kind of outreach and providing information, we got a 100,000% return on investment last year. So it's really, for developing countries, this is really, I think, an important model to consider. Yes.
Denise Leonard, Open House Systems, but ex-World Bank. I remember talking to the Bollywood producers about the point with maternal health, that high-risk pregnancy is the biggest problem getting the woman to the clinic was the mother-in-law. And I asked them whether they could use this in their films. And they said, the problem is the stock character is the nasty mother-in-law, and nobody's going to change the behavior because of the way the mother-in-law changes. But what I was more interested in about was, have you talked to Bollywood? Like, for example, I know there each Bollywood filmmaker gives a certain percentage of time to this kind of thing. So have you taken this model and used it in Bollywood, or talked to Bollywood about using it, or the South Indian film programs in Madras or Chennai?
Yes, actually, this past year, we went to India twice. The first time, we held a public Hollywood-Bollywood exchange event. So I had five writers and producers with me from Hollywood, and we brought in the Norman Lear equivalent from India, Ramesh Sippy, who's really, he's been in the entertainment industry for about 50 years, and he's very important in Bollywood. He opened the event for us, and he said we had the Writers Guild, Directors Guild, and Producers Guild of Bollywood, of India present. And he said, you know, this is the model we need to adopt. And he talked about his very first success, which had a storyline about a woman who died in childbirth. And he said he remembers to this day that they kept hoping they were portraying it right. They didn't have anybody to go to. They didn't really have a resource or a system set up. So I've been in touch on a regular basis with that community, and they want us to help them set up a Bollywood Health and Society, you know, adapting the model we're using. So we're talking to some potential funding partners about that, and if any of you have any ideas, we'd be very interested in speaking with you. Yes.
Thank you. Steve Morrison, that was an excellent presentation. Can you talk for a few minutes about public affairs shows and what role they play in this? We have a monthly forum here with Bob Schieffer, which is sort of a crossover program. And mm-hmm. We've done one on global health, one program last fall is very effective. We know that the News Hour is investing much more in terms of public public media mm-hmm. on global health. You know, ABC is trying to do more, and
right. And
we don't see much on the public affairs shows routinely in terms of content and interest. Do you have any comments or insights across those? Thank you.
Hollywood Health and Society works primarily with scripted shows and some with reality television. We aren't working with the news shows, but I'll tell you how the news piece links into our work. We create a quarterly newsletter that goes to 800 writers, and we basically rip headlines from the news. Writers are always stealing headlines from the news for their storylines. In fact, we just had a panel the night before last at the Writers Guild that was actually on cancer, and one of the writers on my panel was saying, yeah, you know, we steal headlines from the news all the time to create stories around them. So news stories are important to writers, but only after we've grabbed and held their attention. And the way to do that is not by asking them to watch, you know, a long discussion. It's really by, you know, sort of looping back to the beginning, to the earlier discussion. It's by presenting real stories of real people. So we'll actually take someone from another country or someone who's had a condition and survived or someone who's had dire consequences from not getting treated, and we take that person into the writer's room. Once the creative team engages in this idea and they start to create a story, then they'll watch an hour-long program or they'll read journal articles. They're very well-informed and bright people, but they're busy. So the key for us is that initial grabbing and holding of attention. And then we have tip sheets. So we write, there's sort of two sides of a page, condensed versions of talking points. And we would never just distribute those. They're posted on the CDC's website. You can check them out there or on our website. But we pair them with compelling speakers and real stories. And again, once they're engaged, they'll read those tip sheets. So, yes. Okay, sorry.
Thank you. Magdalena Serpa from Colombia, South America. And I'm in the board of directors of Glasswing International, a Salvador-based NGO. We're working, trying to retain students in school so that they don't get into gangs. Ah. And I was very interested in your talking about the problems of gangs in Los Angeles. And I would like to know if you're interested in doing something to help us and help other Central American countries, being a Latina.
Ah, thank you. Well, I'd love to talk with you about that. The writers were so impressed. I mean, and going back to really the Gates Living Proof framing, we don't take writers in just to see problems. We take them in to be inspired by innovative solutions and community leaders and young people who are, you know, amazing in what they're doing with their lives. So, you know, our sort of primary interface is with those writers, because if we get a TV storyline that tells the story in a compelling, accurate way. First of all, let me pull out this data point. 52% of regular viewers believe that the health content they see on television is accurate. They believe it. 26% say that TV is among the top three sources of health information for them. This can be very frightening if that's inaccurate. You know, we don't want anybody relying on storylines for their sort of, you know, education or accurate information, and yet we know people do. And so our primary commitment is to getting accuracy into these stories and also to getting timely, important stories told. And, you know, we reach people who are not even asking the questions. And, you know, I found an interesting data point this morning comparing average viewing time of web streaming on the internet to average viewing time of television. Does anybody know what it is? 21 minutes per day for web streaming, 222 minutes for television per day. That's an average. So traditional media still counts. And, you know, the internet's very important, but we like to link the two. So that's our commitment. But we can talk afterwards about your program. I'd love to learn about it.
Hi, thank you so much. Abby Weaver from PATH. And you talked a lot about this really wonderful model that works, and I'm curious if you've learned any lessons or learned things that didn't work so well, whether it be a particular topic didn't resonate or another strategy didn't work.
Yes. I have so many lessons learned. It's, you know, in Hollywood you learn it really quickly because you really can't afford to sort of go off the rails. But so one thing is we don't put our name on anything. We never ask for a credit. Sometimes they want to give it to us, and we say no. So we always put them in the limelight. This is about helping them succeed at what they're trying to do, and because of that, it really builds trust. So that's one. Two, we don't partner directly with advocacy groups. Any group that is associated with one issue, even if they are the same issues we care about and are pitching, because writers, we can't afford to have them see us as advocating for a single thing. So we represent health very broadly. But within that, we have certain priorities every year, and those are the ones we take. So that's a key. Another thing is we don't take funding from pharmaceutical companies and other companies that have a very clear agenda, because writers have agendas pushed at them all the time, and they don't want that. And so this keeps us trustworthy. I'd say another thing, you know, we've had some amazing experts who really have a hard time talking in language that writers are comfortable with, and that hasn't worked very well. So we really try to prepare. It doesn't mean a scientist who's, you know, who's not a storyteller can't talk to writers. They actually love working with scientists, but it means we really have to do a lot of coaching with our experts and maybe with all of you in this room to have three compelling stories that you can rattle off about a real person in a real place with detail, some conflict, something overcome. That's really important. If we start with that, we took Atul Gawande. Many of you know him. He's a surgeon, Harvard trained, works with the World Health Organization on the Safe Surgical Checklist. And I took him to meet with the writers of ER. And I have the clip with me. We just didn't have time for it today. But, you know, he started with a story that had absolutely nothing to do with his topic at all. You know, family in Austria, little girl drowns, and, you know, had nothing to do with the checklist. It never came into the story. But the story was a case study from the literature. It was so compelling. We were all on the edges of our chairs. We wanted to know what was going to happen to this little girl. And it was breathtaking. It was minute by minute. And at the end he said, "So I told you this story to show you what happens when medicine goes right." And then he led into his checklist. Well, it turned into the most compelling 3-minute storyline. And we just got inquiries from all over the world about how that got on the air. Thank you.
Please join me in thanking Sandra. You know, I said at the beginning that we were challenged in thinking who could possibly give a keynote for this kind of event, and we feel so lucky that Sandra was able to join us and share these insights that are so far beyond our beltway thinking that it's really it gives us new dimensions to incorporate in the work that we're doing. We're going to now turn to our final panel. You have all been incredibly patient. Amy Batson is the Deputy Administrator for Global Health at USAID. And Steve Morrison, who you've met, the Director of the CSIS Global Health Policy Center, are going to say some words. And Amy will speak for a few minutes, and then Steve will give some reflections, and then we'll close. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So I've learned a lot of new terms, and I know that now what the term of transportation is. And unfortunately, I'm not even going to aspire to transport this audience. So I'll go for another term, which is brevity. I think, you know, with global health, when I started 20 years ago, it was an arena of sort of a certain set of experts. It was the medical experts, the development, the logistical and training. And we would have long technical reports that we would give to each other, and long technical meetings where the more technical you could be, the more points you basically raise for yourself as a true expert. And it's kind of funny to think now about sitting in one of those WHO meetings and showing a clip from Bold and Beautiful and about how incredibly impactful that could be at getting attention and really educating kind of populations that need to be educated. I think even today, thinking of showing that clip at WHO would be quite an adventure. But there's still a role for those experts, but I think we're seeing the value of adding a whole new cadre of expertise into our world of global health. This ability to kind of package information in a way that's truly accessible and compelling is fundamentally changing who cares about this issue, who feels engaged in it, and what they feel they can do to contribute toward it. So this power to not only reach people, but actually reach their hearts and turn what was an alien experience of somebody else into something that they can relate to and want to know more about and potentially take action on is just unbelievably powerful. And it is taking our world of sort of a limited number of experts who talk to themselves and turning it into something that is so very different. I think it was very interesting to also hear about going beyond the U.S. I think, you know, we have a very TV-oriented, media-savvy U.S. environment. But when we think about some of the countries we work in and the power of this messaging and the, you know, the access that, that media has there as well, it really is very exciting. And you look at some of the stories like what India has just done in terms of remaining polio-free for over a year, and the 2 million health workers and volunteers that got mobilized in that country to reach the 178 million children. What a story. And I'm sure there is more drama than any of us can imagine that went on behind the scenes in terms of making that happen. But to turn that into a story that Indians can hear about and be proud of and see the sort of have it reach to them, incredibly impactful and potentially incredibly meaningful as we strive to change the story around child death. Right now, 7.6 million children die every year. We actually have the tools, the knowledge. Some countries have shown the way that we can end preventable child death in a generation. India is 22% of those deaths. So to have a story that reaches, goes through Bollywood, and reaches Indians about their children, about the power of what they can do to help prevent those deaths, far, far, far more impactful than, you know, 1,000 of our technical meetings. In the U.S. as well, we're seeing just a growing hunger through schools and universities and faith communities and in the general population. And it's thanks to this kind of media that's been going on, the videos that we saw that are starting to reach and take what would be these alien experiences and bring them home to people. And so this hunger is great because it's creating more and more demand for this kind of outreach and engagement with them. So we've added a new list of experts for us to consider and to really think, how do we open up our world, continue to open up our world, continue to drive it and reach all these populations? Because it's very clear that ending preventable child death, something that's imminently possible if people care, if there's the political will, if there's the funding, we have the tools, we have the knowledge, it is possible, but it comes down to if everyone cares enough to do it. Doing that's going to require more than our experts. It's going to require the world collectively to engage in it. And it's very clear that we'll only get there through these new kinds of channels and outreach. So really exciting day, very, very motivating for me to see and hear all of these different ways forward. And look forward to working with you and with all of you in this room in terms of how we start acting on this even more and driving it to the next level. Thank you very much.
We've gone on for a long time, and I thought we could use the this concluding section really to try and hear a little more from Amy on some of these issues, since she's a very much a leader and a recognized leader within the administration on these issues, and she's been she's had great impact and has been a very good friend to us. And thank you, Amy, for that. And maybe we can hear from a few of you and go on for a few more minutes, and then we can adjourn. A few things as you were talking, a few things that occurred to me. Everyone here has been talking about crafting stories that have power in convincing people. And today, in the midst of the current austerity and budgetary uncertainty and the debate around what can we afford to do and what can we sell to the American people on an enduring basis, having a storyline becomes obviously a vital portion, and having people to tell the story like Secretary Clinton becomes a very vitally important. But also I think the arc of it becomes important. People now want to know what the long-term vision is and what's the end state going to look like, and how do you tell people that, you know, we are, if you make the longer-term investment, that you will not be creating a vast global entitlement where we're paying the freight indefinitely, but rather you're creating something that transitions into something that is carried and endures through time, because those that are most responsible are going to embrace that and carry it forward. That storyline, I think, is very important politically on the Hill in the media with the American public, with an American public that is going to ask these questions, and I wanted to put that out as a very important issue. The second part is, it's striking to me how much vaccines are counter-cyclical in a way. I mean, you're in a we heard earlier the golden age of the naught decade had passed, and now we're in a period of scarcity and, you know, no new initiative. Well, the reality is that vaccines have done very, very well in this last period. The decade of vaccines initiative that will be presented at the World Health Assembly in May, the pledging conference for Gavi, the turnaround in Gavi's fortunes, which has been a dramatic and very welcome change, the change of position within the U.S. government. I mean, Bart, thanks to your effort, the pledge of $450 million. There's a greater sense of the value and the Best Buy aspect and the like, and it would be useful for you to talk about that. And then a third issue is really looking out over the landscape. This year is a difficult year in some ways because we're in the midst of a intensely contested electoral cycle. We're in one where, around women's health issues, it's become fraught with hardened up and very embittered kind of confrontations of late. It's going to be very busy, but we also have some major events coming forward, the Child Survival Summit in June that you're going to be very instrumental in, the AIDS 2012 gathering here in Washington, 20 to 25,000 people, the first time in 22 years that this conference will have returned to U.S. soil here in Washington. We have the campaigns themselves. At some point, as we get into the debate cycle in the fall, there will be a foreign policy-oriented debate of one of the three debates, and there will be questions around foreign aid and then questions around what do we get and all of these. So this is a year that's going to be crowded and noisy and difficult, and there's a particular warp or just polarization to what's happening now. But on the other hand, you have certain people like the President and the Secretary of State and Republican advocates of global health who have remained pretty resilient in this period and very visible. So how do you see this, Amy, as you look forward as to the things that we should be thinking about and looking for and what your hopes are for trying to complete the first administration of the first Obama administration on the sort of best possible footing on the issues that you're looking for and crafting that correct story? That was a long question, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and so much for my promise of brevity. So I think on this, trying to hook all of these together maybe, this long-term vision, a sense of where are we going, and when we get there, is this sort of, you know, the U.S. and other OECD countries giving and giving and giving forever with no end in sight and with demands just increasing? How does what we do and how we do it matter in that picture? And then, you know, with this child survival focus, what does that mean and how does it fit in? A tremendous amount of what we do is all about, it's not about malaria, it's not about TB, it's not about immunization. It's about whether a person lives or dies, right? And mostly whether a child lives or dies. So all of those interventions which we focus on, they're not ends in and of themselves. They are tools to protect children and protect families and communities from dying or from having sort of extreme sort of morbidity, you know, terrible symptoms and morbidity. And so this focus on child survival is really the unifier. It's saying, where are we trying to get to? We're not just trying to get to a malaria goal. We love immunization, but we're not just trying to get to a coverage of immunization. What we're getting to is ending preventable child death, ending that enormous disparity that of that 7.6 million children that die every year, 6.5 million of those could be prevented. Okay, that's what we're trying to end. So that it's not a huge difference whether you're born in a rich or a poor country, whether you live or die, because we have the tools to make it the same. So with that as a big unifying goal, then it becomes the what do we do? Well, this is the good news, and this is where things like immunization and other interventions really rise to the top. We have incredibly cost-effective, high-impact tools that can reach a child in a village and give them the same protection that my daughter gets when I go to our Bethesda high-tech a pediatrician and get the vaccine for her there. And it's the power of the technology. And it is so cheap and so easy to deliver, and it provides such coverage for that child, such protection for that child. So when we look at this endpoint of what are we going to do, how are we going to get, where are we trying to go with all of this, what's really exciting is we can now see that endpoint. We've had such huge declines, 70% reductions in child mortality over the last 50 years, with the rate of decline accelerating with each decade. So that now, huge achievements, we're down to 7.6 million. And we can now see within a generation, within our lifetime, that we can end this. And how do we end it? We really learn the lessons of what to focus on, and then very importantly, how do we get it out there? How do we reach the child with immunization and with malaria prevention and with basic nutrition? The sort of things we all know, we all know the what's. We know what's killing kids. We know what the interventions are. The big issue that we're making huge strides in learning, and the countries are leading the way, is the hows. How do you actually get a health worker to a community? How do you engage a community leader, a faith leader, to be telling mother-in-laws to let their child, to let the woman go and deliver in a facility rather than staying at home like she did? She's certainly not going to listen to WHO or USAID or some international doctor, but that mother-in-law probably will listen to her faith leader, to her imam or her preacher, if they say it. And the importance of reaching that group and letting them own their own kind of goals and messages and working toward it. So we see this kind of shift. With this child survival call to action in June, it's also very much about this mutual accountability. It is not an issue of donor recipient, which is kind of actually just defined a lot of our discussions in this space. It's about every country, every parent, every community, every parent cares about their children, and they care whether their children live or die. It's about the accountability we each have to our domestic challenges and to helping contribute globally. And so the framing around this meeting is how do we get raise that political will and get other countries coming to the table with our country and each looking at domestic challenges and global contributions in a different way? How do we raise the transparency on that progress and really give more recognition for those who are moving the goal forward? So that we are changing the diagram, changing the picture, and there is an end in sight. There are countries with economies that are growing quite nicely. Not ours, but others, right? And how are we ensuring that they are translating those economic gains back into their children and their future? I think we also are seeing that the kind of arguments around this end game of ending preventable child deaths. We all know that, and it's an interesting fact, that the CIA uses child mortality as a statistic of instability. Because if there's one thing that'll drive a parent to do anything, it's watching their child die. And die of something that's imminently preventable and that is being prevented in another country. But because their government, their structure is not sort of taking on the responsibility and delivering it, that parent is going to fight back. So security, our security, the world's security, becomes very linked to something as fundamental as whether families, parents, communities have hope for their children and their future or just see them dying with nobody caring. We can also get into sort of the technical things, the economic, the demographic dividend that comes from child survival with more family planning and changing sort of the overall shape of the demography of a country and the sort of contributing adults to dependents of children and older populations and the tremendous impact that that's having. And countries like Asia that have done the investments in child survival, in family planning, in particularly women's education, and the economic result of that is pretty striking. And more countries are starting, and ministers of finance and heads of state are really starting to look at that and try and understand it and see what can they learn. But it takes a 10, 20 years to get that payoff. So there is an end point. There is great hope. I think going back to the Hill and saying that the monies that we've been using have brought us to this point of being able to envision a world where we can end preventable child death, and that as leaders in this field, the U.S. technically, financially, politically, we can really help deliver that, is something that's very motivating for the Congress and is one of the reasons why this is one of the areas that has the strongest bipartisan support of anything on the Hill.
May I ask you, if we could talk a little bit about tools, because we've talked a lot about how the video and social media can be used to reach new audiences. And let's talk about sort of how your thinking has evolved over time and using the leadership of this administration and using others to try to connect through these media and these opportunities to an American people to sort of make the case. And I know you're scheduled now to be on the Bold and Beautiful soon, so you can talk a little bit about that. And but also, how are you? How have you been thinking about video and social media and other means, as we've heard today, that really do have, as we heard from Sandra, you know, high impact attitudinally in terms of response and the desire for people to take action, which I assume your child survival summit and the Safe Mothers initiative that has been in preparations, these are things that you want Americans to connect to and feel part of and be responsive to and join with. So if you could say a word and then we'll adjourn.
So what we're seeing is there is a real thirst for information. And, you know, any one of us, we've all gone onto the web and we know exactly what we're looking for because we're professionals in this field, and it's still hard to find that piece of data. And so an attempt to the value of our making websites which have much more timely data, much more visually accessible data, the geospatial mapping that you can do with this data to make it kind of come alive, it has real power, and we're seeing that. Particularly on the food side, where we have some new websites making this information available and getting extremely positive results. Because it's not about telling people what to think, it's about providing the data and allowing people to come to their own conclusions, to make their own thoughts and use it out there. We're also seeing that this is allowing us to reach to broader audience. Universities, you know, the growth in class demand for development, but particularly for global health, is unbelievable. We're hearing story after story about universities that are finally, you know, opening classes in this, and they're 8 times, 10 times oversubscribed. So just tremendous desire to learn more, to have access to this information that we're trying to help meet. I think importantly on the child survival front, a big recognition that this is something that American population, for example, cares about very deeply. And it really does align with America's sense of values and how we should be playing a role globally, that our children are very fortunate. They do survive. They do have, at birth, they're a good survival rate. They have nutrition. They have access to immunization. And that's something we want to share with the world. So we are in April 4th, we'll be launching a special social media campaign that'll be all about this ending preventable child deaths and how are we reducing that disparity between the rich and the poor countries and the tools and the knowledge we have and the value of things like immunization and putting it in the frame of what this world can do with this. So I think we're getting much more creative in terms of breaking out of our box of just talking to those few experts and instead really reaching out to the community at large to tap into their desire to understand more, their willingness to share that message with others, their willingness to fund, not us, but to fund partners that are doing important work in this space, their willingness to share their really clever technical ideas that sometimes address something that none of us have thought about, a solution no one else has thought about. And their willingness to even volunteer their time and their expertise in some capacity. So it's opening up a whole world, and what's really important, I think, for us in USAID is we're looking at how do we become more of a platform to help share all that information and unleash all of that incredible kind of talent and capacity and energy to really help us all solve these big global challenges.
Thank you. Janet, do we have time, or should we adjourn, or do we have time for a couple of questions or comments? Do you have time?
I can say very
quickly. Why don't we take a couple of questions and pool them and then come back to Amy. So, sir, if you could, and anyone else that would like to jump in, please put your hand up. Yes, sir.
Great. Thank you, Amy, for being here and for your brief presentation.
We saw a lot of examples. I'm David Rubenstein with the Best Shot Foundation. We saw a lot of examples today of video and social media and learn to be engaging and even transporting, which is wonderful. And Amy, you just spoke just moments ago about talent and capacity and energy that you want to unleash. But when we're talking about people seeing this and experiencing this and becoming transported, we then want them to take action towards certain ends. And I'm wondering, we haven't spoken a lot today about advocacy actions and action steps that we want people to take. And so I'm going to ask you a little bit about what action steps you'd like to see taken, but more important, what would the ends be of those actions? What are the ultimate ends that you'd like to see that all of this energy can be used to make happen?
Thank you, David. Any other comments or questions? Okay.
It is all about taking action. And this is an area where we as the U.S. government kind of run into some walls on what we can do, what we do, and where others may be. For us, it's about really sharing information and motivating and encouraging people to share that information, share their awareness with others. We don't raise money. We get it through taxes. But for people who want to provide money as an action, to give that to some very reputable group out there that is doing great work on child survival. We do ask for, you know, technical ideas. So we've had these grand challenges for development that instead of defining what's the problem, what's the solution, and who's going to give us that solution, we're throwing open the problem of safe motherhood, of safe delivery, to the world and saying, anybody that's got a clever idea, bring it forward and we'll evaluate it, and then we'll be funding some with grants. So we're asking them to use their knowledge, their brain, their particular expertise to help us solve some of these tremendous challenges. So it's we're trying to unlock by giving out the information and creating the awareness, and then we'll be looking to other partners to help say, okay, so how then do we use that? How do we use it for awareness building, for volunteerism, for fundraising, for something that they can, that the world can then use to help address sort of our shared goals.
Well, Amy, thank you so much. Janet and everyone else on the team, congratulations. Sandra, thank you for coming this distance to be with us. Amy, you've taken time out of your busy day to come and share your thoughts. Thank you. Thank you all. We're adjourned.